Okay, again, find your seats. Jim, are you ready?
James, I am.
Yes, I know. I'm sorry.
Well, that was the worst introduction I've ever had. No, go sit down. I'll take it from here. So let's start this over. My name is James Whitaker, and I'm not new to Microsoft. I've been here about a year, but this is my second tour. I did a little sabbatical at Google, I think, for a few years. This is actually my first public talk after returning. And I've given this talk a couple of times internally, and I always like to start it by saying this is not a G-rated talk for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'm not a G-rated guy. Try to be, it just doesn't work. And secondly, these are not G-rated times. There's some pretty serious opportunity brewing in the market right now. And a G-rated approach just might not get you many places. However, I've been told, James, this is not an internal talk. It looks like one because last time I gave it was in this room. But you all aren't Microsofties. So you're going to get, is this okay with you? The G-rated version of this talk. No? PG? Maybe?
Higher?
You really, you all just want to hire me. You want me to get fired, right? Okay, so I'll try my best to kind of walk that PG-13 line. Just a little hint about what you're going to see. Some of what you're going to see, even though we have this kind of magical background and we talk about new things, some of the stuff you're going to see is very familiar to you because this new era has already begun. I'm going to date it precisely a little later in the talk, but it's already begun. So a lot of these new things are beginning to emerge. Some of them you're going to see is very familiar. We're going to try to tease apart what's going on here, figure out the ingredients of this new era, and hopefully share some ideas that you guys can take advantage of to build your own businesses. Some of it's going to be aspirational. These eras tend to be in 10-year increments in computing. And so we've only just begun this. In fact, last year, we only begun this. So we have a long tail of innovation ahead of us. And that's going to be the aspirational piece. And also, there's a lot of uncertainty in this. You'll see me at times puzzled about what's going to come next. You're going to see me putting together pieces of a puzzle and saying, it might be this. And it might be that, and that's okay, because we're early in this new era, and it gives folks like us a chance to actually take one of those paths. So, you with me so far? If you're not having any fun, there's the door. If you are having fun, please wait till the end, and I'll take some questions. Okay, so I talked about this new era. There have been some old eras too, things that we all know and love. But I think it's useful to talk about some of these things because they will help inform how we take advantage of this this new era that's coming. It all begins in the 1990s for me. In fact, I think it began, the real magic started in the 1990s. In the 60s, the 70s, and 80s, we had computing, but it was only available to a select few. Access to computers was very difficult to come by. You had to work for one of the big tech companies, the government, or a major research university. It just wasn't available to the masses. So I don't count before then. I count in the 90s, which I'm going to call store and compute and talk about a little bit, because there was some serious magic that was brewed up in this decade that was dominated by Microsoft. Might even talk about that a little bit too. I mean, if I'm going to lose my job, I'm going to throw myself completely under the bus, right? You don't want to come out of this other thing alive, be, you know, the Walking Dead or something. The 2000s I call search and browse. And the thing that brought this along, of course, was the web. And the magic shifted. The problems that we could solve shifted. I'm going to talk about some of those. In fact, I'm going to talk about what I consider to be sort of the penultimate problem that we solved in each of these eras. And then I'm going to spend most of the time talking about what's now and what's next. So let's begin with a place that every talk should begin, a quote from Arthur C. Clarke. Right? I've used the term magic already. Am I justified in using the term magic? Well, by this definition, I am. Right? The stuff we're doing now couldn't have even been envisioned by our grandparents. In fact, my grandparents, well, they're gone. But my parents still can't get this in their head. This is magic to them. It's like a cigarette lighter to a caveman. Whoa. And we have invented some really seriously magical things. Because if you go back in time, back before the magic, back into the Muggle time when I was born, see, I'm old enough. Let me just go ahead and display my age here. I'm old enough that I was born and raised in a time completely devoid of magic. I sat on the front porch of my house with my baseball glove and ball in hand. For you of those who aren't from America, this is a sport we play here. Waiting for the promised game of catch with my dad, right? Son, as soon as I'm finished fixing the car, I'll play catch with you. He was never finished. The car was too hard to fix. And I would sit there with my glove and my ball looking at that car, pissed off. I wanted magic to fix this car so that my dad would play catch with me. Now, when I was little, I didn't picture magic of the wand, the Harry Potter variety, or the Gandalf the Grey variety. Certainly not Radagast the Brown. What was that stuff on that guy's head? I always pictured it as a machine, right? A machine that would somehow, my dad would hook this machine up to his car, and the machine would say, oh, yeah, it's that little bit over there. And then it would walking through the fix. Wouldn't that be cool, I thought. It was always a machine for me. And then, let me see, it must have been June of last year. My phone buzzes. And, of course, it's your phone. You must be obeyed. It buzzes, and so I pick it up, and I look at it, and I got a text. And it said, James, this is your car. It was a text from my car. I kept it. I change phones, but I always forward that text to me on the new phone. This is your car. And it told me what was wrong with it. I drive an electric car. The battery was out of balance. The battery... And it told me how to fix it. That's what I wanted. But I was born too soon. God, you young people are so lucky. And it's not because of the youth. It's because of the time you were born in. Actually, I often find youth annoying as hell. But the time you were born in. Oh, you're so lucky. Because now we have that magic. That very magic I wished for as a child. And it didn't stop there, right? I wanted life-extending stuff, too. When my grandfather got ill in the 1980s, same picture went through my head, right? I want a machine to fix my grandfather. And I pictured it, right? It had this big circle in the human body. My grandfather's body would just be chucked unceremoniously into it. And it would whine and blink and whirr and make weird noises. And he'd come out the other end fixed. That's the part I got wrong. You just come out the other end, freaked out. But it came true, right? The magic. Little boys and little girls of this era are enjoying their grandparents far longer than little boys and little girls of my era because of the magic. Now, what's the magic? Remove software from this equation. Remove it. That car is not going to be sending me a text. That machine that analyzes PET scanners, CAT scanners, MRIs, whatever you call them, doesn't exist. Software is the one ingredient, along with human intelligence, that makes this magic possible. That's it. Go ahead. Take software away. Take software away and solve global warming. Go ahead. Try it. Take software away and cure cancer. Go ahead. Try it. You can't. Right? It's the one tool humanity needs over and above human intelligence itself. It's our only hope. So, what have we done with this magic? More than that. Right? Back before the magic started in 1953, one of the most important discoveries of the century was made. Crick and Watson discovered, identified, deoxyribonucleic DNA. DNA, right? And they made some startling claims about this. DNA is the building block of life. It is a genetic record of not only where we're going, but where we've been, right? Evolution itself is contained in this structure. And in order to convince us of that, they modeled it using the medium of, is that Lincoln logs? Really? Not exactly the most expressive medium in the world. There's very little we could do with this discovery, despite its importance. The 50s passed, we're like, that's cool. 60s passed, there were some results. Well, yeah, we think they're right. We do think it's important. 70s passed, we're pretty damn sure it's important. The 80s passed, yeah, we're positive it's important. And then 1990 came, and humanity had the audacity to start the Human Genome Project. The H in that is important. The Human Genome Project. They didn't set about to map the genetic structure of some inert organic substance. They didn't set out to map the genome of a laboratory rat to sequence an arbitrary human's genome. Wow. What audacity. It was canceled in 2003, by the way. Yeah, go ahead. Blame it on Bush. We blamed everything else in those few years on him, didn't we? It was canceled in 2003, not because we ran out of money, not because we had some moral objection to it, not because some bureaucrat said it's not important. It was stopped because it was finished. We did it. Thanks to human intelligence and the magic, we did it. Of course, it was incredibly expensive. In 2001, you could get your genome sequenced if you had about 92, 93 million to spare. Right? You could walk into what I'm thinking is a really nice clinic and get your genome sequenced. But today, in 2013, it costs about $7,800 to get the whole thing sequenced. If you want only the important bits that relate to certain diseases and catastrophic stuff, that's only about $300, right? Anybody can afford this now. This is stunning. And in the near future, it's probably going to be covered by Obamacare. I don't know. Software was what made this possible. Take away software and this didn't work, right? And this is courtesy of store and compute. This was done largely in the 90s based on the technology of the time, right? Locally stored data. Local computation, because that's really what that decade was about. The data fled the back rooms of universities and private, you know, government research and big companies to our desktop. We could store our own data. We could write our own programs to compute with it. And we could do some amazing things. We did a lot of amazing things. This, I think, was just the most amazing with that technology. But like all technologies, it runs its course. And computing seems to be on this weird 10-year schedule. And the web came along. And the web changed things fundamentally. All of a sudden, we could do more stuff. We could store more data because we could put it in a data center. We could get access to that data more easily because we didn't have to get a local copy. We could compute with it, with crowdsourcing models, right? We could all work together across geographic boundaries on the same thing. And crowdsourcing has solved some really cool problems. To me, the signature problem of the 2000s, of the search and browse decade, is nothing short of exploration of the universe itself. We went in the 90s from looking at the very building blocks of life to, in the 2000s, looking out beyond our own horizons. Now, we weren't the first to do this. People have always been looking up in the heavens and saying, what the hell is that? Now, some people thought they saw things that other people didn't think should be there. Peter Van de Kamp, in 1969, he had been looking at this star for years. He had been taking handwritten notes on the behavior of Barnard's star for years. And he noticed something that the math didn't explain. The star wobbled. And stars don't wobble. The math doesn't account for a wobble. And he did the math, and he redid the math, and he kept taking his observations. And the damn thing kept wobbling. And then he decided, well, how do I explain this wobble? How do I make the math work? Well, a planet 1.6 times the size of Jupiter, about the same distance as the Mars is from our sun, made the math work. It was the only thing that made the math work. But the problem is, this is Muggle time. And I recall watching, this must have been Nova or some channel, there's only four of them. And they were talking about this, right? They were presenting his paper, they were presenting his evidence. The scientific community was looking at the evidence. There were religious scholars discussing the evidence. The scientific community looked at it and said, we must reproduce your experiment. We must reproduce your data. Dude, it was handwritten. Good luck. It's going to take years. We can't reproduce your data. We can't reproduce the experiment. We can't find other corroborating means. Therefore, you're wrong. It's unproven. The religious scholars didn't like it much either, but they just said no. And I felt so sorry for this guy. Oh, I was watching Nova or whatever it was, and I just wanted to stand up and say, are you idiots? Don't you watch Star Trek? This stuff's real. I wanted a machine, right? I wanted a machine to fly out the Barnard star. There it is, look. Take some pictures, go back to Earth, look. Watch Star Trek and believe. It turns out he was wrong. Barnard star seems to be alone. But it didn't take long until the magic began to be applied to this problem. And by 2003, we had our first there's a planet moment. Not based on theory, not based on tradition, not based on anything else. Incontrovertible scientific fact. Now, it wasn't the machine I envisioned. It wasn't the machine that took us out to Gamma Cephei and said, look, there it is. Our machines, our software, brought those planets to us. Right? Software made the telescopes more powerful, the grinding of the lenses more accurate, the collection of the data more automatic, the reproduction of the experiments a given. They made us so that we could look in different variations of light and radio and microwave, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They made the problem solvable. This is what the magic does. They make problems solvable. And the magic has been kicking ass on this. This is the search and browse decade. This is many of these planets were found at home on people's home computer. Right? This is crowdsourced right now. You can go out on the web and search for planets. This is stunning. This is a signature problem of the search and browse decade. And it is nothing short of celestial. Now, it makes me anxious for the future, doesn't it? But is the future here? Is this decade over? Well, certain luminaries have been predicting that this decade was over, that this era was over for a long time. Steve Jobs was probably the first. He's been predicting that search is a dying industry, that search volume, because he saw it increasing at a smaller rate, month over month, increasing at a smaller rate until September of 2012, first time ever, total search volume through a browser went down. It went down. And then it went down in October. And then this is month over month, right? Year over year. So comparing October, because it went up in November, because that's Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but not as much as it was last year. It goes down. All right, so four straight months now. Total search volume has going down. What is happening here? The search and browse era has ended. And I'll date it at September of 2012. When total search volume went down. We don't need to search anymore. It turns out that if you search long enough, you find a bunch of stuff. And you don't have to search for it anymore. You lose your car keys once and you say, where are my car keys? And you form a search. You don't know where they are. But by the 11th or 12th time you lose your car keys, you pretty much know where you tend to leave them. And you don't really have to search anymore. You lose your dog at the dog park. You lose your dog. You lose your kid at Disney. It happened to me. It's not fun to think about. Found the little bugger. Didn't lose him again. No. Didn't lose him again. Right? You've seen the tethered kids in Disney. Right? You change your behavior. You're not going to lose that thing again. You found it once. Put it in your pocket. Keep it where you can get it out. This is what's happening, right? Apps are ingesting the web too. Apps are better at searching than browsers and search engines. I love to play this game. When I first got back from Google, I still had my Android phone, and we were all out watching a soccer game, Champions League soccer game. See, I do understand the sports everybody else plays. We play it too, just not very good at it. We were watching a soccer match, and so I always like to try to get a free lunch. So the contest is, pull out a phone, right? Chelsea was playing somebody. Everybody, pull out your phone and find out the score of the Barcelona game. Start now, right? And if the first one to find it out doesn't have to put a credit card down at the end of the meal. Now, it didn't matter whether you were on Android or a Windows phone or iPhone or anything else, because all those phones were represented at that lunch. The person who won had the soccer app. The soccer app boots to the latest thing that's interesting, score of the Barcelona game. Everybody else has to search. So apps are fundamentally a better way to search because they're only looking at the part of the web you happen to be interested in. How do we know you're interested in it? Because you're using the app. So our habits are changing. And this era has ended. Now, does this mean, search engines have no value? Of course not. Right? Desktop computing still has a value, and we're a decade away from that. Things in this industry tend to have very long tails. But this is where we are. Now, in each era, this magic has gotten stronger and stronger and stronger. We're able to solve harder and harder problems, which is a good thing because we've got some pretty hard problems as humanity on the horizon. This next era, I am going to call the know and do era, because it turns out we really have found a bunch of stuff. We don't have to search for it because we know it. We don't have to browse around trying to accomplish tasks because we can just do them. I'll give you a couple of examples. And a couple of examples that are current, a couple of examples that are aspirational. And we're going to pick this decade apart. Now, people often ask me, what do you think when you give this talk in 10 years about the fourth era, what will be the signature problem of the 2010s? And I always say I don't know, but they made me guess, and this is my guess. My first guess was global warming, just because I want it so much. Right? I live in the Northwest. I'm a tree hugger. I can't help it. I drive an electric car, and I turn off lights, and I annoy the hell out of anybody who's around me with these types of behaviors. But I just don't think we have the political will to solve this problem. I think it's going to be mapping the brain. If you look at the amount of progress we're making here, the amount of money that's being invested and who's investing it, right? People with a big track record of success, and the quality of the people that are working on this, we are going to understand the brain during this era. We are going to understand not only that this neural connection has a certain function, but how to form the neural connection to begin with. And I think we're going to begin to see this at the education level first. We are going to understand how people learn, and we're going to teach them right. We're not going to drag our teenagers out of bed at 5 a.m. so that they can go to school and learn the same way our agrarian ancestors learned 200 years ago, and then get home early enough to sow and harvest crops. We're going to figure this out, and people are going to learn much faster, and humanity is going to get smarter much faster. But anyhow, that's just my guess. You can form your own guess about what it's going to be. But I will tell you this. I'll make this point one last time. Take software away, this doesn't happen. No solution to this or any other big problem happens. This is the most important tool humanity has. So, let's take a look at search and browse and do a little comparison. In search and browse, if you're hungry, you fire up a computer, turn it on, and wait, and it powers up. And then you click and clack and clickety-clack, right? Keys and clicks. And you go to a search engine, and you say, okay, why did I come here? Oh, yeah, I'm hungry. And so you type restaurants. You got to tell it where you are. It doesn't know. Tell it where you are. And it says, oh, okay, you want restaurants in Seattle. And then you browse, and you get blue. That's not a restaurant. That's a blue link. But anyhow, there it is. You can click around. You say, I don't know if this place is any good. So you can click around some more, browse around some more, find some other people who might or might not think this is good. And then you still got work to do. Once you decide that's the place, you still got work to do in search and browse era. Pick up the phone, you call them, you make a reservation, right? This is search and browse. We have been dealing with this stuff for 10 years. Now, in know and do, it's a little bit different. The devices have changed. And you literally do tell it what you want. I'm hungry. Intent is part of know and do. Inputs are part of search and browse. It says, okay, you're hungry. We know where you are, right? We've got other signals that we can take advantage of. So you ask it, and you observe the results. And these really are restaurants, right? These aren't blue links. These are entities. Google has entities. Bing has entities. We know what a restaurant is. We know that it's different than an auto shop. We know that number is a phone number. We know that number is a Social Security number, right? We've searched enough that we've learned a lot of things. We can observe. And then none of this offline stuff, right? There are things out there like OpenTable. We can just make the reservation at the place for you at the right time. We can take into account other signals, too. If you're looking for an Italian restaurant and it's 6 a.m., you probably want reservations. If you're looking for a burger and it's noon, you probably want to eat now. Right? All of this extra information, all of this intent that is replacing inputs, that's know and do stuff, not search and browse stuff. And it's important because we can take advantage of it. So if you take a look at the old magic versus the new magic, there's some important things that I want to point out because I think as business owners and developers and innovators, you should make choices that bet on the new technology and not the old. The old technology is inputs. The new technology is intent. What do our users really mean? We can figure that out now because we have such a variety of signals. We know where you are. We know that you're moving. We know what you've just asked for. We know what you've asked for in the past. We know what you've been happy with in the past. We may know more about you than be able to come up with answers without having this long click, key, click, key, etc. SERP is the old, answers is the new, right? SERP is a nice monetization mechanism if you own a web browser, but it's kind of dated, isn't it? A bunch of blue links. I don't want blue links. I just told you I'm hungry. I can't eat a blue link. Answers. We know the answer. Who are the members of Coldplay? We know the answer to that. When is the Muse playing in Seattle? We know that. What bar has the best happy hour in Bellevue, right? There are things that we know. The answers, the things that we know right now, number in the billions. We don't have to look them up anymore. We don't have to provide a bunch of opportunities. Right? The SERP is, look at the little number at the top of either Bing or Google of how many relevant pages there are for any particular search query. It often numbers in the hundreds of millions. You get 10 on one screen. It's crazy. Right? And it's not always relevant. That can be bought. Right? Cure for cancer. Oh, buy a cure for cancer at Walmart. Cures for cancer are 30% off at Target, right? These results are not always what you want them to be. Answers is the new answer. Now, what this puts into question is the web itself. How much value does the web provide? Because right now, in order to get noticed, if you're a new restaurant in town, and let's say you specialize in takeout, how do you get noticed on the web? You pop up a website, and you hope to get ingested by Google and Bing and get your relevance numbers up so that you finally get into that coveted first page. Or you pay for it. You hire SEOs that help you figure this stuff out. Right? I'd really rather you just cook and make the food better. But the web is an endpoint that is becoming less and less critical. We have web indexes, structured data, entities, and answer indexes that are a surrogate for the web. The number of times we have to go out to the web for an answer is getting fewer and fewer and fewer because we already have the answer close at hand. The structured data that we have on hand, that the world has on hand, is becoming a surrogate for the web, and it's only going to continue. Browsers. Go ahead, read the news on CNN.com if you want. Give me Flipboard, please. It's beautiful. It's a nice experience. Just like when I could have a big travel book of Hawaii and sit it on my lap and page through it instead of clicking here and clicking there and clicking here and clicking there. It's a much nicer experience. It's a beautiful experience. It's a magazine quality experience. And this is the future. Ugly web pages probably won't get you very far in the know and do era. Ads and offers. Ads are everywhere. They make, I was going to say lots of companies wealthy, but they make money and they get business. And why? What do they look like in this new world order? If it really is an answer that I'm getting, where is the ad? Where is the ad on that small screen? Well, I think the ad will be built right into the entity. If you're searching for a burger in downtown Bellevue at noon, I would like to buy that keyword. My restaurant would like to buy that keyword, not with money to Google or the search engine, whoever, but with an offer to the person who's searching. Come in, check in, and you get a 15% discount. Right? The offers are timely because you're actually wanting a burger. There's no ad involved in it. It's just an offer to form a temporary relationship between seller and buyer. And finally, experiences are going to replace apps. Now, this one is probably a little controversial because I just said apps are replacing searches. Apps sound like they want to be part of the know and do era, don't they? But I don't think they are. I don't think they can be. Apps are a throwback to store and compute. Apps are the way we used to do it back then. Apps require a lot of work. Actually, apps kind of piss me off. We're getting to the point where we're back in the 90s. I write an app, and now I've got to test it on this version of the operating. There's a multitude of phones I've got to test on, and I make sure the app runs on this. Even the same damn phone has 10 different versions of the operating system. And one handset maker completely changes it, and another handset maker completely changes it in a different way, and my app won't run on them both. And then users have to update apps all the time. This is just like the 90s. This isn't an improvement. This can't be part of know and do. This has got to be something that we leave behind. Yes, it looks more modern than web pages. And yes, it's a superior way to search, particularly subsets of the web. But please, please tell me there's something better. And I do believe there's something better. I'm going to call it experiences, and I'm going to talk about it in a little bit, because I don't think apps are going to do it. Are we okay? You're kind of quiet. Still interested? Should I continue? Or just give it up? Okay. All right. We're good. So know and do. This is what it is, right? Know basically is data. It's the stuff we have about the world. It's not the web. It's our index of the web. It's our structured data. It's the things that we know, right? And you know, this data can sometimes be very hyper-local. Right now, we are depending on giant companies to give us local data about Bellevue, Washington. Why? Just because they're the only ones that can serve it at scale? Who knows the restaurants, the bars, the taverns, the nightlife, the shops in, say, Bellevue, Washington, better than the people and the Chamber of Commerce of Bellevue, Washington? There is an opportunity in Know and Do for people who have data. Data is valuable. And those people should have a way, if we're really going to get beyond this search and browse stuff, those people should have a way to monetize that data. We know this stuff better than anybody. I wanted to say Americans, but I can't. The Brazilians and the Argentinians and the Dutch and all the other Europeans and everybody else in the world is looking forward to the World Cup. Next summer, not this, 2014. That is valuable data. Collect it now. If you're passionate about soccer, football, it's hard to call it football when the Super Bowl is on. Do you know why Americans call it a football? Has nothing to do with our feet. Do you know, you Europeans and you South Americans who make fun of us for calling it football? You're going to make more fun of us when you find out the reason. The damn thing's a foot long. So, hey, man, we're Americans, right? All right, so data is valuable, and it doesn't matter who has it. In Know and Do, it doesn't matter who has it, because the speed and the scale of the internet needs to be publicly available, right? We need to have the ability to be able to deliver this at scale. So this is the do part. If you've got data, how do you do something with it? Well, these are, I'm going to call, experiences, not apps. I started wrangling with the term scenario. That's okay, too, because that's what it is. It's code. It is an app in the traditional sense. It's software that weaves a story out of data. It's software that makes your television experience viewing better. It's software that when you're in Bellevue, Washington, and you want a beer, it's going to help you, right? It takes the data and weaves it into really cool things. Now, we're going to be able to do this in ways during Know and Do that we couldn't do in search and browse. This isn't about popping up some web endpoint and waiting until we get ingested in some search engine's index. It's different. Right? There are going to be spot markets in Know and Do that are just going to pop up. This isn't about just some big giant with some big data that wants to make big money. It's going to be a lot of little people with little data that want to make a little money. Little spot markets, like right around noon in downtown Seattle, there's going to be a lot of bidding for people searching for food. And right around the time of a concert, there's going to be a lot of bidding for tickets. There's going to be these little spot markets, these little micro markets that pop up around specific pieces of data with specific experiences woven through them. We're getting to the aspirational bit here, but I'm going to give a pretty solid example in a moment. Now, let's give some general examples of what this would look like. Let's say a travel experience. I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a business idea here. There's a link, it's really small at the bottom of that bottom of this slide right now. Go to that. It's the top 10 terms and industries that advertise on Google. Take some data and build an experience around those 10 things. There's a lot of money there. Right? If you wanted to build an experience around travel, there are people that own the data. Now, that data sometimes is kept private. That data sometimes is sold. That data sometimes is rented. That data can be bought, curated, and sold for more. That data can have experiences woven through it. And this travel is one of those top 10. Another one of the top 10 is shopping. Again, there's a lot of data here. And the opportunity to take that data and build novel experiences through it. Not web experiences. Experiences, and I'm going to get to the host of these experiences in a minute. And another one I think could be interesting is autos and vehicles, right? It's top 10. Lots of money for this data, lots of interest in the data, lots of interest in experiences around the data. What is it going to look like when the web goes away? What is it going to look like when it's just the data and just the experience on your device with no web in between? I think it's going to be stunning. Data is currency. It doesn't matter if you own it, it's valuable. If you harvest it, it's valuable. If you curate it, it's valuable. Data is the new currency of know and do. You can't know without data. Now, there's a piece missing to this, because we still have to figure out how to get the people with the data, to get the people who can code the experiences together. And the people who want to code the experiences need to find the people with the data and work with them to build their experience. This is a dependency here. And there's actually a third leg of this stool, which completes the circle, and it's all of those services in the cloud and on the device that allow us to build the experiences over that data. But cloud and device sounds awkward, so I'm going to come up with a better name for it. Now, here's what those devices might... Oh, look what rendered. It's a Windows ecosystem. Imagine that. Now, just because I work for Microsoft, you might be saying, you put that in on purpose. And it's not true. I had a very independent way of selecting which ecosystem went on this slide. As long as it didn't begin with the letter A, I would consider putting it on this slide. And this is the one that happened to be there. So anyhow, now you know, totally unbiased, totally independent. It just happened to be for the company I work for. So now devices are part of this. Devices without apps, mind you. I don't want this. I get a new phone and I have to install all my apps. I don't want that. And I don't want to have to, I hate that little number in my little live tile. It says 4 needs to be updated. And a couple days later, it says 6 need to be updated. And I'm just, I'm not going to update you. I'm going to see how high this number gets. Download a few more that need updating. But the device is important, right? The device is the connection to the user. We must have this device. And the services on that device must get more powerful, because they have to be able to take some of the weight, because I'm not going to allow apps. I want the apps to go away. They have to take some of that weight. And the other thing that has to take some of that weight is the cloud. And other things, I love saying cloud because it sounds vague, but it sounds cool at the same time. So people think you're giving an answer when in fact you didn't. Oh, it's in the cloud. Every time one of my developers, where are you going to store it? I'm going to store it in the cloud. No. Come here. Show me your code. Cloud is a bad word in my dev team. So there's a bunch of other stuff here. And it is, and again, Microsoft ecosystem didn't begin with A, you understand, right? So there's a bunch of other stuff here. Some of it's in the cloud. Some of it might be on another device I have. Why is it that when I want something, only my phone can give it to me? If I'm sitting in front of my Xbox, I want it through my Xbox. I want it through the device I'm looking at now. So I call this an ecosystem, because that's really what it is. It's the collection of devices that I look at, and it's a collection of services that I subscribe to or have access to. This is the three-legged stool of the know and do era. It's data with experiences woven through them, using and hosted on an ecosystem. And there's lots of interesting stuff we can do here. I think the canvases that we are using to consume information and data are going to change. Right now, mostly our canvas is the web, or it's some app that does certain things. I don't necessarily see the need for that. To me, the two most important canvases that I can build experiences on top of them are space and time, because that's a user's life. You exist in space and time. You exist temporally. You exist spatially, which means most of my experiences can be built on a calendar or on a map. Most of the things I do in my life are controlled by space or time. Spatial and temporal canvases as part of the ecosystem. I can render a temporal canvas, a calendar, on my Xbox. I can render it on my phone. I can render it on my Surface. I can render it on my desktop at home or at work. Why should it matter? Right, this ecosystem, the broader it is, the more powerful it can be, and the more types of things I can do, no matter what device I'm looking at, and no matter what cloud I'm connected to. So let's go through an example here. I want to go through an example because we are firmly in, I believe, the know and do era. Things are fundamentally changing, and watch it. It's happening now. When you start Googling and Binging and searching, a lot of times you're seeing way more than links. Bing already divides its homepage into three, right? The web knows, Bing knows, which is our structured data and answer index, and Friends Know, which is the Twitter and Facebook feeds, right? It's changing. Google's doing the same thing. You will do a search on your phone for something, and you'll be delivered the entity. And the little link at the below will see, if you'd like to see the web links, here they are. Why would you? Because the answer is known. You're seeing this more and more and more on modern devices. So what might an experience, a know and do experience, look like? So here's one that I think is a real pain and a real opportunity for some entrepreneurs. So here you go. You implement this if you like. I look at my calendar sometimes and think, oh, my God, I need a vacation. This is awful. Now, in search and browse, what would I have to do? In search and browse, if I want a vacation, I have to go to, I don't know, how many websites? I need to go to some aggregator like Expedia. And how many times you go to Expedia or something like that and you look it up and then you go to Delta and buy it, right? I don't know how these people, it's amazing to me that this whole thing, it's like you can cheat on your website. And then the car, and then the, oh my God. And then you get there and you realize, I haven't booked any activities because you were so tired from booking all that travel. But now here's the thought I want to put in your head. These experiences should not be on the web. The web is the past. Where should these experiences be? Look in that ecosystem that I had on the last page and ask yourself, where does this experience start for the user? Now, I don't know about you, but for me, and I think you, start I Need a Vacation by looking at your calendar and saying, when the hell can I get out of here? It's Seattle, and it's January, and it's raining. Hawaii sounds really nice. When can I go? Calendar. This experience starts in the calendar. Now, the funny thing is it ends in the calendar too, doesn't it? Because after you've gone through all these web pages and cheated on them and slept around and clicked and clacked and all that other stuff and gotten to the other end feeling like a total whore, what do you do? Because look how much money you've made for everybody else. Turn that into discounts for my vacation, please. You go back to your calendar and enter it all in so you know when to leave. And what your confirmation number at your hotel is, and car, and all that stuff. Why should an experience that starts and ends in a calendar take you anywhere else? So, somebody code this for me. So here we are, in the calendar. What would an experience, what would a nice know and do experience look like? How about Hawaii in May? You know what, that third week looks pretty nice. It's kind of clear. Okay, clear my calendar. I'm gone. I don't like any of those people that I'm meeting with. Anyhow, thank you for declining all my meetings. Show me flights out on Sunday. Okay, this is nice. Now, see, it's already better, isn't it? You ever have to do layover math in your head when you're booking these things? Is that a long layover? Is that a short layover? Man, I have a PhD in computer science. So I feel like an idiot sometimes. Oh, my God, I don't realize it's a 4.5-hour layover until I'm there. I had a friend of mine staying, a PhD in math, mind you, staying at my house, didn't realize he booked an 11 p.m. flight instead of an 11 a.m. flight. Well, that's pretty obvious when it's rendered on the calendar, isn't it? Right, the layovers are there. There's one that's cross day. You don't have to look at nons. You don't have to tell it. Sort, put the nonstops on top. Right, it's just there. It's just more natural. This, I predict, we're going to find and know and do. Things are going to get better. This webification of stuff is just ugly. It is. It's latency-filled muck. sort by duration, sort by price. Sort this. Has it been fairly G-rated so far? Am I doing kind of okay? Okay, so I'll take that short one, please. That nonstop. Yes, thank you. Okay, so what's next? Yeah, I'll have a nice hotel. I work for Microsoft. I can afford it. What's this stuff? Anything else? Ooh, look at that one in the middle. Bonus time. We'll have that one. Thank you very much. That's the way to pick a hotel. This is no and do. And then what about all that blank stuff in the middle? What else is there? Go ingest the stuff, right? This is the data from the Hawaii Chamber of Commerce. This is the data from Social Graph of other people that I know that have been there, right? I don't have to go and ask them. It's just there. It's just ingested. Any data that's useful, my device, the agent on that device that's representing me, the capabilities that are built into that device that serve me, do this for me. And it's going to be interesting for me. There's tons of signals that we can use for this. Activities for the week. All right. We legalized marijuana here. Our activities for the week in Seattle are going to get pretty interesting fairly soon. I'll take that zip line tour. I'll take that thing there because it looks yummy. And then you can see how you can just fill this out, right? We can also go to the hotel that you just booked. We understand you've got two kids. Let's figure out if there's some kids' nights out, the parents' nights out where the kids are taken care of. What's the activity calendar? Get all that stuff done in advance on your calendar, right? No going out to the web. So code this or don't code this. Maybe I'll code this. But this is a know and do experience. It starts where it should. It ends where it should. And you don't have to get dirty in the middle. So that looks like a nice vacation. All right, so here we are at the end. We're going to have some time for questions. We are in a new era. It began in September of 2012, and if history is anything to show, it's going to last about 10 years. It's just started, so get busy now. Start thinking in a different way. Start thinking about data, experiences, and ecosystem. Think about your user and where these experiences should start and end. Start saying goodbye to the web now. Start saying goodbye to search and browse now, because a new era is beginning. And the thing I like about new eras is it's often difficult for the incumbents. It's often difficult for the big guys. It's often difficult for the wealthy to really survive in this. Right? At the end of the 1990s, the decade Microsoft owned, Google clearly owned the 2000s. Who's going to own the 2010s? Right? Could be any of the names that you're probably thinking in your head. And it could be something, someone that has no name as of now. And it could be you. My name is James Whitaker. I work for Microsoft. I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you'll come code in the know and do era with the rest of us. Thank you.
So, Jim, any questions? Oh my God, nobody? I don't see a single question.
Now, what's going to happen is they're all going to rush up afterwards and ask me questions.
All right. Well, thank you.
What's that?
His question.
It's a question. All right. So, to feed experience, you need the data, of course, which is the no part. Would you expect the no part to be living in the device, or would you expect the no part, should we then think about the cloud as a universal data center in terms of data and just leverage the services so we don't carry the data?
I think the data will live in two places, between the device, either the device or the cloud. And you know, the device meaning your phone, the collection of your phone, your television, your desktop, your, you know, what you have in your hand, what you have in your pocket, and wherever your eyeballs happen to be pointed. And, you know, there's a lot of proof points for this. So we have to figure out, you know, do we store the private stuff on your device? Can we manage privacy in the cloud? Privacy, by the way, I'm happy to say, will have to be solved in this. Now, we've had to solve privacy for a long time, and the industry at large hasn't really done a great job with it. No one do requires it. There's a business case now. Data is more important than ever. There is a business case for the people to solve privacy. So to me, it's between the devices and the cloud. Basically, where it is now, it's just going to be handled in a lot different way. Yeah.
So my question, and this comes up a lot for the client that I work for. It's a medical device company. We do service applications for them in every country, 170 countries, something like that. So when we talk about U.S., not even all of Europe, you know, we're talking about 4G connections, data, great. But most of this, correct me if I'm wrong, is going to require some pretty sophisticated data networks, and there's a lot of the world at this time that you can't even kind of having a 3G connection. When our field reps are out at their hospitals and clinics, they might not have any sort of network connection for several days. So do you see that changing, or do we just add X number of years when we talk about these parts of the world?
Well, you know, doesn't do anything to increase this problem. In fact, perhaps, you know, the devices are going to be a little bit smarter. They're going to work with cloud in a little bit smarter way. The ecosystem itself can be tuned. The web is very difficult to tune because it's big and giant, and people can do anything they want with it. But the ecosystems can be tuned to be a little bit faster. So I don't think we've created any new problems in this area. Perhaps things will get a little bit incrementally better. I do believe, the one prediction I have in this is that there's going to be enough value created in the know and do era that adding data center capacity and getting smart about data center capacity and the companies that rent data center capacity are going to have one heck of a decade.
Okay, one more before they all rush the stage. All right, cool.
Hi. So you mentioned that the era of search and browse had a lot of things like search engine placement. You just showed a calendar doing a nice job of finding me a vacation. I would imagine that placement on that calendar would be a thing that would be essentially sold to the people who wanted to be on my calendar.
So here's how I want that to work.
So that's not the end of my question, though. My question is...
Well, that means you have two questions, because that was a question.
That was a context.
Oh, okay, so, good. Context.
So the question is, assuming that's true, why would I trust that calendar to give me good advice? What's the monetization, the motivation for me to trust that system?
Okay, good. I don't think you've wholly changed my answer. So let me give you my first answer. The way I want it to work is I want the user to be involved in this auction because it's still an auction. You've got data. There's an experience that is capable of weaving through either one of those, which gets chosen, right? I want it to be based on a number of things. Certainly, buy it, right? There should be some offer to the person who has the experience and the ecosystem that says, all right, this is worth this search term, this term, or this capability during this time is worth 15 cents to me. So that would be one part of it. Now, I'd like it to work a little bit differently than that, though. I'd like to put the user in charge of this, too. So the auction would not only contain the amount that the experience maker and the ecosystem maker agree on, but also value to the user. So it may be that the ecosystem could get 20 cents for that, except that somebody offering only 8 cents is offering more value to the user. So it would be a bigger value, right? So if I'm selling burger, the term burger, in Bellevue, Washington, and you bid 20 cents for it and a 10% discount, and someone else bids 8 cents for it and a 30% discount, they should win it, right? And the user should have to be, you know, we should be able to surface that to the user and say, look, this is more value to the ecosystem, this is more value to you. And that ought to be somehow involved in that. And then also track record, right? If you're in Bellevue, Washington, and you search for burger, and Burger King happened to pay us the most for that, you're in Bellevue, Washington, man. Some of the best restaurants in the world. And you want a burger, and you're going to eat at Burger King? Really? You know, it's not going to get clicked on. I don't care how much they pay for it. That extra signal of nobody's interested in your junk, dude. And so we're going to put the other ones at the top. All right, so I want an auction system that takes into account not just the profit of the ecosystem and the experience owner, but also the person who is going to consume that service. Actually, I'd like that now. Was that it?
That's it.
All right, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.